You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mahaere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whae kēnei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the party's stance on Te Tiriti o Waitangi in light of this past Waitangi weekend, and the Employment Relations Amendment Bill in light of a recent protest. I also spoke to Senior Lecturer in Sociology at the University of Auckland, Avril Bell, about public sentiment on Te Tiriti and interpreting the government's stance on it. Alex, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Education and Social Practice at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jude MacArthur, about the government's recent moves to fund new special schools for disabled children and what that says for exclusivity versus inclusivity in our education.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e warawara e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more, as always, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
This Waitangi weekend saw politicians gathering at the treaty grounds to pay homage to Aotearoa's founding document. At the event, party leaders and MPs from across Parliament spoke gave speeches around the significance of Te Tiriti for their work. ACT leader David Seymour spoke about colonisation, stating that it wasn't all bad and that there were some positives. Seymour also acknowledged the tensions around the Treaty Principles Bill from last year, which he called a Pyrrhic victory. Also last Thursday saw protesters from the Workers' First Union gathering outside the office of Workplace Relations Minister Brooke Van Velden to protest against the Employment Relations Amendment Bill. The union says this bill will take rights away from workers and put them in a place of uncertainty, which is especially worrisome as unemployment reaches its 10-year high. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked about each of these issues, beginning by asking about this Waitangi weekend. I wanted to start off talking about Waitangi this past weekend. What were the ACT Party's main takeaways from this Waitangi weekend?
Well, ACT is focused in our policy work and in the messages that we share with New Zealanders around Waitangi, that we are all one people, we have equal rights, and that we must make sure that we protect and uphold those equal rights, you know, either whether it's before the courts, whether it's property rights through, say, the resource management reforms, which ACT is championing, or when it comes to freedom of speech. And I think what we saw at Waitangi again is that while there are many, many people there keen to engage and debate important matters, there is a loud, obnoxious group of people who want to shut that conversation down. And actually, they're rude, because when they're on somebody else's, in somebody else's place, and you know, the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, you are a trust. It is essentially a form of private property. Now, they behave in a really rude and obnoxious way. Kiwis watching that might say, ACT, why do you bother going? David Seymour, why do you bother standing up to give a speech when there's just idiots swearing at you and trying to disrupt? Well, look, we're there for all New Zealanders because we want to make sure that people understand that equal rights and having an opportunity to see New Zealanders as having a shared goal, unity, that's what we're there for.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the stuff that David Seymour said in that speech, because I think it's pretty unfair to represent it without also getting into what people were responding to. Towards the start of his speech, he rejected claims that colonisation was all bad. Given colonisation's staggering negative impact on the environment in Aotearoa, on Māori in Aotearoa, on many other minority groups in Aotearoa who either arrived here afterwards or arrived here beforehand. Should we really be defending the process?
We should be celebrating it. You've got to remember that when the Treaty of Waitangi was signed, it's estimated up to 40% of Maori were enslaved. Britain ended slavery, was the first Western country to do so, and it ended slavery in New Zealand with the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. There's just one example. Now, while it's absolutely correct to say that colonisation meant that people who were living on land that was sold couldn't live there anymore because somebody else moved in to develop it. That's the same around the world. But you look at all the benefits. You know, we now have the rule of law in New Zealand. We have our property rights protected. No one's enslaved, we hope, with there's laws against that. And it's clearly been of massive benefit.
So are you saying that we wouldn't enjoy these benefits of laws, of the lack of slavery, if, you know, thousands of Maori didn't have their land stolen or scammed away from them?
That's a zero-sum argument, and that's not the right approach to take. It's quite clear that prior to the Treaty of Waitangi, there were significant land sales of very large areas. In fact, there was one I was reading about over the weekend when a British settler claimed to have purchased the entire South Island, and he had the signature of six South Island chiefs, which he took to Sydney and tried to have ratified by the government of New South Wales. He said, "We're not ratifying that. That's outrageous. No one would have willingly entered into that contract." And so that's why the Treaty of Waitangi was proposed and then signed, to provide for those property rights, to make sure that sales of land were lawful and legitimate. And look, all New Zealanders have benefited from having their property rights protected.
And speaking on the importance of te tiriti, Seymour also spoke about last year's Treaty Principles Bill debacle, calling it a Pyrrhic victory. Could you elaborate on what people should take away from that?
Well, we were disappointed that our coalition partners didn't support the Treaty Principles Bill, but that is the nature of being in a coalition. But what we do know is that New Zealanders, when asked about the principles that we put forward, like equal rights before the law, they attracted broad and widespread support. And ACT's position hasn't changed on this. We believe in equal rights for New Zealanders, and we'll keep making that case constructively and respectively, despite the way that some people might react emotionally to that. And we'll have more to say about what form that takes in the coming months.
Given high protest turnout, given turnout from academics, from activists, from people across Parliament as well, from every party other than the ACT party, against this bill, do you think it has a future in New Zealand politics?
Well, like I said, we will have more to say about what form our approach to making sure that equal rights, you know, through some kind of recognition of those principles, is enshrined in New Zealand law. We'll have more to say about that in the future. But what I will say about all the people who've turned out to oppose it, if you ask them, should New Zealanders be equal before the law? Should their property rights be protected? And, you know, should essentially New Zealanders, you know, notwithstanding specific provisions and treaty settlements, all be treated the same when it comes to seeking natural resources or having decision making or over natural resources? Shouldn't we all be equal? New Zealanders overwhelmingly agree with those statements, which is essentially all the Treaty Principles Bill was. And so, you know, I think what will happen, and David Seymour's made this case a number of times, you know, you look at how many times the End of Life Choice Act, or Voluntary Euthanasia as it was once called, were proposed to Parliament and rejected either through referendum or bills that were voted down. Homosexual law reform, you know, decriminalising homosexuality was first introduced in the New Zealand Parliament in 1974. Eventually it was legalised in 1986, despite much opposition. And no one would say that either of those two changes to public policy and the law have had anything but positive outcomes. So look, watch this space.
I also wanted to talk about the Employment Relations Amendment Bill. We saw a protest over this bill outside the Office of Workplace Relations Minister Brooke Van Velden on Thursday. Could you go into, just before we get into the protest, what the Employment Relations Amendment Bill would actually do?
Well, it makes four practical changes. It reduces this grey area around contractor status, so businesses and contractors know where they stand. It tightens up the personal grievance payout, so when an employee's own behaviour caused the dismissal, it limits those unjustified dismissal claims. And it also limits unjustified dismissal claims for high-income managers. And finally, it removes the 30-day rule so that employers and new staff can agree terms from day one when a person starts their employment.
The protesters, including the Workers First Union, say that this bill will be a grave attack on workers' rights, and especially with unemployment hitting a 10-year high over the past week, are we really in a good place to be, you know, being concerned over workers' rights and reducing the protections that our workers can see?
Well, let's flip that around. If it's hard to employ people, or it's hard to get rid of people if they turn out to be wholly unsuitable or actually damaging your business, then what we want to do is make the employment conditions far more flexible. That's how we're going to get more people, who many of whom are at the margins, into employment, which means that their lives are just immeasurably better as a result of having that routine, having a regular income, having that social contact, all of those great benefits we get from employment. That's what the legislation is intended to do, provide more flexibility. But I'll just give you one example. At the moment, when a contract that a contractor signs says they're a contractor, that can still be challenged years later, and that creates real uncertainty and cost. And what this bill means is that clear, agreed contracting arrangements are going to be upheld. Now, if you want to protest against contracts and the rule of law, fill your boots, but I can guarantee that employers will be much more likely to employ people if they're confident that the employment agreement is lawful and will be upheld.
That's sort of the part I want to contest, that part about contractors being able to contest that later on. The main criticism of this bill that we're seeing is that employers can treat people like employees. They can take the hours from them that employees would do, and because they're hired as contractors, they'd be denied, minimum wage, sick and annual leave, public holidays. You talk about how this will guarantee people security in income. Would this not do the opposite for many people out there, forcing them into roles as contractors rather than full-time employees?
Well, the whole purpose of contracting is so that the person offering to work can choose which conditions that they're prepared to accept. They're not prepared to accept the conditions of the contract, and I know lots of people who contract, whether they do fixed-term full-time, whether they do part-time, long-term contracting, or whether they offer their hours on an availability basis, they do that knowing that they have to pay their own tax, that they have to pay their own ACC levies, and that if they want to contribute to KiwiSaver or a private pension scheme, they have to do that out of what they earn. But that is a free contracting environment, and what it means is that if you have a number of different businesses you might want to offer your contracting services to, you're not limited to only signing up with one and having all of those obligations and impositions on you. You're free to work. That's what contracting's all about. It's glorious. I would encourage your listeners to the show to consider that as a way of working.
You're implying, though, that these contractors have a choice of work, that there's lots of availabilities, and let's say if they don't like one situation, they can just not go for that job and go for something else. But given unemployment is, again, at a 10-year high, do they really have this, availability of opportunities?
Well, let's be clear. There are parts of the economy where there is higher number of people seeking work. And you look at Auckland, for example, where I live. There has been a downturn in the housing and construction businesses. Retail has been quiet. Hospitality's been quiet as we've gone through the recession, the higher interest rates. We're coming out the other side, but that's clear. You look at Canterbury, they've got a 2.3% unemployment rate. That means basically, apart from a few people who have changed jobs and haven't found the next one yet, they've got full employment down there. So there's never been a better time to offer your services in the private sector, or in the public sector for that matter, because lots of councils and government, seek contractors for short-term or specific roles. There's never been a better time to polish your CV and think about how you can maximise your intellectual property, your skills, and turn them into a really good contracting rate.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about Te Tiriti o Waitangi and the Employment Relations Amendment Bill.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Are our affairs current?
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Silver Eye by Earth Tongue.
Baxter Jury is heading to New Zealand for the first time ever to show off his excellent new album, Alberoni, and 95BFM has tickets to give away to the show. If you have a B card, they could be yours. Just keep that dial on breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Baxter Jury, Alberoni album tour, the Hollywood Avondale, Sunday, May 3rd. Tickets on sale now from livenation.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Thick black mascara and little black curtains. Two little holes in my neck that was bitten. Black velvet capes with stylish bat wings. These are a few of my favourite things.
It's the sound of music, but not as you know it. The 95BFM Monday 1 to 4 with the sinister sister and goth mother superior, Penny Black. Tune in to hear our dark diva spinning nothing but the unholy best from the Devil's Discotheque. Brought to you by Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road.
Tony here from Tikawiti. I've been listening to your sheep show every week with the girls week in, week out, and I hold out for some actual sheep content. You know, it's all music, and I've had a gutful. How about a little less the clean and a little more how to clean your Toyota Hilux after a massive dagging session? Either pull your bloody head in or change the name of the show, okay?
Ovinophiles are welcome to listen, but Freak the Sheep is really about that good, good New Zealand music. Freak the Sheep delivers interviews, live performances, tempered classics, and wretched demos from Godzone.
Freak the Sheep with Taylor McGregor and Chris Cudby. Wednesday nights from 9 till 11 on BFM. Thanks to New Zealand On Air.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire. Welcome back to The Wire. This past week saw multiple polls on public support for Te Tiriti o Waitangi in lawmaking. In RNZ's Reid Research poll, while 38.1% thought Te Tiriti had too much influence, 34.1% thought it was just right, and 16.6% called for more influence. The complex array of approaches to Te Tiriti were also on full display this weekend, with politicians and MPs talking about what it means to them. Some of the narratives shared, especially by the ACT Party, who have previously framed Te Tiriti's role in politics as taking away rights from Pākehā and favouring Māori. To discuss all of these attitudes, I spoke to Senior Lecturer of Sociology at the University of Auckland, Avril Bell. So, in your article, you talk about a recent RNZ poll on Te Tiriti. What were the results like? And you talk about how they were presented. What did they show in the article, and what more was there to them?
Yeah, that was really interesting because it was an RNZ Reid research poll, and the question was something like, I've forgotten how the wording of the question was, but, you know, about basically asking people about what they thought about the role of Te Tiriti in our government or in our politics. And the most common response was that people thought there was too much emphasis on the treaty in our politics, right? That was a bit over 40% of the respondents. And that was the headline they put on the news coverage of it. But when I read the article, if you put together with almost as many people, like 36% or 34%, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly now, who thought that the role of the treaty in our politics was about right. And then there was 16.6%, I think it was, who thought that it needed to have more emphasis and more place in our politics. So I thought, you know, actually, if you put together those two figures, the 40-something percent who thought it was about right and the 16.6% who thought there should be more emphasis on the treaty or more space given to it, really, what that said was, you know, a majority, just a bare majority, I think it added up to 50.7 or something, but a majority of the people who responded to the survey actually felt positively about the role of the treaty in politics and wanted it to have even more emphasis or more place. You know, so I thought it was just kind of unfortunate that the news coverage that I saw had emphasised what I consider the negative. You know, the view that there's too much focus on the treaty and failed to kind of point out what I saw as the positive side. So that's what inspired me to write that opinion piece that you saw.
And if we're thinking about, I guess, how this poll result interacts with what we've seen over the past few years, you know, with the Treaty Principles Bill response, do you think the public is, you know, in majority supportive of incorporating Te Tiriti more or certainly protecting and holding Te Tiriti quite important in Aotearoa?
Well, you know, if we consider that the pollsters, I think those pollsters are people who are making an effort to sample representatively, right? It's not like a random radio station, sorry, not being mean about radio stations, but, you know, sometimes you get radio stations say, you know, call in or send us an answer to some question and you just get some random group, but they will have got a representative sample and over 1,000 people. So if we take that as, you know, reasonable indicator, then I think we're probably split, you know, as a population, we're relatively split around between people who are positive about the treaty and people who are not, but with a bit of an emphasis on the positive people. But I think, you know, so I think despite, well, whatever this government has done over the last few years, I don't think it has eroded the positive view that has developed over a much longer time period.
And a bit more on our government as well. We saw at Waitangi this weekend party leaders talking about Te Tiriti. We saw Chris Luxon in his speech talking about the treaty articles and his interpretation of them. We also saw ACT Party leader David Seymour talking about colonisation being a net positive for Aotearoa. Mm-hmm. What do you make of these speeches?
To be honest, I didn't listen to them. I didn't listen to any of the politician speeches, so I'm only going on what I've seen reported. What I feel like about, I mean, you know, I have heard people saying that it's how kind of sort of offensive for Christopher Luxon to be trying to talk at Waitangi to the people of Waitangi about the treaty as though, you know, they need to be educated by him about the treaty. And with as far as David Seymour is concerned, I mean, he knows he's not appealing to the audience when he says those things. So I guess one of the things I'm left with thinking about those speeches is that they're very monological. They're not seeking a conversation. You know, so in a sense, to me, they're antithetical to what the treaty is about, which is really about establishing relationships, maintaining relationships, working on relationships, whereas neither of those speeches seem to me to be particularly interested in relationships, unless it's entirely on their own terms.
And so if we're thinking about now the majority that you mentioned who are interested in seeing Te Tiriti having the same role, or that 16% interest in seeing it expanded in politics in Aotearoa, what does building on those things look like from a political, from a legal perspective, if we're constructing a society that has more emphasis on Te Tiriti?
Ooh, that's a good question. And, you know, I'm not a political scientist or a constitutional lawyer, but those are the things that come to mind. I mean, for one thing, just to sort of we need to hold the ground, and it doesn't mean reviewing the Waitangi Tribunal with an idea of, you know, disbanding it or limiting its powers even more. It doesn't have massive powers even now. It only has recommendatory powers, right? It can't make the government do anything. So it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean getting rid of the treaty out of our legislation and out of our education system and our health services and so on and so forth. So that's the first thing. And I think the other thing about the treaty now and into the future is that it, for a long time, it has been a framework and a kind of a talisman, or I don't know, you know, that has given us a focus for conversations about, ongoing conversations about who we are as a people, who we are as a nation, our relationships with each other, particularly, of course, Māori and the rest of us, and about our history. But you're asking really about the future. And I take heart from the fact that there's so many people who are positive about it. I don't have the answer to this question, but I think that any future changes to our political makeup and our political systems, the treaty has got to be a fundamental part of that. We have the frameworks that were discussed in Matiki Mai, and those are a component for kind of more conversations that can take place around what kind of future political system we might have, where the treaty is enshrined and the system is organised in ways that kind of honour that treaty.
Lastly, I wanted to talk about sort of the presentation of Pākehā relationships with Te Tiriti in Aotearoa. We've seen, you know, the ACT Party campaign especially, but also the National Party in years prior, campaign on the idea that Te Tiriti enshrines certain protections and favouritism for Māori, and Pākehā are left disadvantaged or with unequal rights under Te Tiriti. Is that the only way to view Te Tiriti as a Pākehā New Zealander, or are there more sort of ways you can relate with it?
That is so erroneous, is basically what I would say to that. I mean, but it's a common view, right? Where people used to think, you know, that Māori are getting so much from the treaty. I don't know if you know Roy Matasmale's fabulous little book, Understanding Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Tiny little book, great resource for anyone. But she expressed it really beautifully in there, where she said that basically, you know, Article 2 of Te Tiriti guaranteed that Māori would have ongoing rangatiratanga over their communities, their villages, their lands and their, you know, their taonga, anything, things that they treasured, right? So it was basically confirming for them what they already had. It wasn't giving them anything else. In the third article, they are guaranteed to have equal rights as British subjects. So they're getting something, I guess, in that respect. But it's really us, the non-Māori, who got the most, if you like, out of the treaty because of the agreement for an exchange for those commitments that the British could establish a colonial government here to govern, you know, its citizens and to be a partner, if you like. I don't know if a partner's the best word, but to work with Māori, right, to share kāwanatanga and rangatiratanga. So honestly, I think it's the other way around. We non-Māori are the ones who've gained the most from that commitment. And certainly it's played out that way because, of course, those commitments that were made to Māori were pretty quickly breached and have been continually breached ever since in terms of the kind of guarantees that they would be able to continue to hold their lands and exercise their own authority over them, etc., etc.
That was Senior Lecturer of Sociology at the University of Auckland, Avril Bell, speaking to me about Te Tiriti o Waitangi from multiple perspectives.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Walls Come Tumbling Down by the Style Council.
Hey! 95.
Raised edge, hands out for balance, slipping you almost grab mine, but you find your feet. And I never wanted so much someone to fall. It's just been a weekend, but in my mind we summer in France with our genius daughters now. And you teach me to play the piano.
BFM and slick.
I don't know what I'm still doing here.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
In late January, Education Minister Erica Stanford and Finance Minister Nicola Willis announced the latest development in their approach to supporting disabled children in Aotearoa, $44 million of funding to build two new special schools. These schools signal a focus on providing options for parents to support their children who need it with a choice for specialised support, but are not without criticism. Experts have expressed concern that this move is turning towards strengthening the exclusion of disabled children from Aotearoa's youth and education, and have instead argued in favour of a more inclusive approach. I spoke with Senior Lecturer in Education and Social Practice at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jude MacArthur, about this announcement, what it means in the context of this government, and what we should be seeing instead for the best outcomes for all of our young people in Aotearoa. What actually will this funding look like, both in terms of the rollout and the final product?
Well, I think we have yet to see that. So the funding is for two schools, one in Palmerston North and one in Drury in South Auckland. And I think, you know, you will have seen that the announcement came with a sort of declaration that this was timely because there have been no new special schools built in New Zealand for the past 50 years. So that's the context for that. And I guess my perspective on this is that it's a bit of a surprising announcement, given that around about the same time, the Minister signed an agreement between the Ministry of Education and IHC to have a bit of a better, closer look, you know, at where funding is going for disabled students in this country.
And looking both at those agreements, like the IHC and the buzz in the government, what has Erica Stanford and the government presented as kind of the intent and reasoning behind this specific move?
Well, from the announcement, which was actually made by Minister Stanford and Willis, it appears that the decision is motivated by a desire to provide parents with a choice for segregated education in special schools for disabled children. And I guess, you know, for those of us working in the area of inclusive education, it's an interesting point, because we would argue that, you know, our policies in New Zealand support inclusive education for disabled children. And that means a quality education with good resources and supports going to local schools so that parents genuinely have that choice, you know, the choice of an inclusive education in their local school. So it's an interesting decision because while this is upholding choice for parents for segregation, I guess we would argue that parents who want their children to go to their local school, which is what our policies say, you know, they have the right, and our legislation also supports that, we would say that parents don't have that choice at the moment. So a question then becomes, well, why are we putting, you know, education resourcing into segregation when we know that that resourcing is really desperately needed in local schools so that parents genuinely have that choice of inclusion?
And with that said, looking at this inclusion, or rather the exclusion, you've called this a wrong-headed decision. Why is it that exclusion is a concern in terms of this funding and these programs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a reason why we have not had new special schools built for 50 years. And the rationale that sits behind that is in part to do with what we know to be the effects of segregation for disabled people. And so this question about education is important because it's part of a much bigger picture about the kind of society that we want to have for disabled children, both today and in their future as disabled adults in our society. You know, do we want that society to be inclusive? Do we want it to reflect a valuing of the diversity of people who we have in our communities? And if the answer to that is yes, and I would certainly say yes, that is the kind of society we want, we need to address the point that children spend a lot of their childhood in our school communities, and our school communities therefore are vital places where we begin to build that inclusive society that we want for children now and in their future as adults. So I'm not sure if that's answered your question well, but it seems to me that allocating funding to segregated settings for disabled children is a backward step in terms of our desire to move ahead in this area. Now, the other thing that I want to mention is that internationally and in New Zealand, our research clearly shows that inclusive schools are the best place for disabled children. And when I say inclusive schools, I don't mean, and I and my colleagues who work in this area do not mean just placing disabled children in their local school. That local school needs to be well-resourced, well-funded, well-supported, so that teachers know how to teach the diverse groups of children who are in their local community and that they're able to do that well. So it means giving the schools the funding they need, and it means giving teachers the time they need to be able to collaborate with others to ensure that, you know, they're meeting every child's need well.
And with that said then, looking towards the well-being of our disabled rangatahi, what do you want to see from the government in terms of kind of bringing in this research into inclusive learning environments? If this is the way to go, what do you want to see?
You know, we already have some really good material from the Ministry of Education that teachers can access now and on the Ministry of Education's own website. And, you know, for me, that's a good thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's upholding what I've just said as being a desirable place for our schools now to be for children. So there's some good work that's been done in the past to enhance this inclusive education. We should be grabbing that with our hands and saying, let's do the best that we really can at every level of our education system to ensure that parents have this genuine choice of inclusive education so that our schools are well-resourced and are able to provide that for our young children and young people. So it's about that, taking that as a commitment and then just working with it and making sure the resourcing goes in that direction.
And so just looking at that point of the resourcing, looking at this inclusiveness in both in contrast and alongside the government's steps with this announcement of $44 million, is this a pivot and go in another direction, or is this kind of just wanting to see this overall funding across all zones for our disabled children?
I mean, I think it is a pivot. If we look at the agreement that the minister has just signed with IHC in December, and which is about the same time that this decision to fund the special schools was made, if we look at that agreement, one of the things that agreement says and what the minister has agreed to is that we need to look more closely at where funding and resourcing is going and what is effectively a dual system of education in this country. And again, so when I say dual system, we've got segregated special schools on the one hand and segregated education systems like special classes and special units and so on the one hand, and then we have inclusive education on the other hand, which is, you know, go to your local school and get the supports and resources you need there. That dual system is internationally known to be problematic. You know, it's difficult to uphold two systems of education and to fund both of them well. And so the agreement with IHC that the minister has signed, I think, is a really excellent starting point now, because what it says is, let's look at where we are currently putting our resources in this dual system, and let's look at the effects of that in terms of equity for disabled children. And I think we know enough already from research that has been done and from reports that have been written by ERO and other groups, NZEI for example, we already know that inclusive education is under-resourced in this country. So that agreement now is a really good starting point, and I would say that before we make any more big funding decisions like this one, it behoves us to really get a better understanding of where the money is going, for whom, and where are children actually missing out, and then let's use that evidence, that data, to make decisions which are really well supported by the evidence. You know, we're sort of at a turning point here, and, you know, as a nation, we really need to be making good evidence-based decisions about where our money is going, and keeping in mind that this is about, you know, how we understand education for all children in this country, and to really keep in mind that connection with the question of what kind of society do we want for our children, both now and in the future. And I mean all children, including disabled children. So I've quoted Sir Robert Martin on this in the past, and I'll do it again now, that, you know, Sir Robert Martin was an amazing advocate for disabled people, and who had himself lived a segregated life through no fault of his own, and was educated in a segregated setting. And he said, you know, there is no special society. And so therefore, it's really important that we design an education system that includes all children and, you know, helps us to work towards that more inclusive society.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Judah MacArthur on the move for special schools and why we should turn to a more inclusive approach to support our disabled rangatahi.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Senior Lecturer of Sociology at the University of Auckland, Avril Bell, and the University of Auckland's Jude MacArthur. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.